of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome. I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your health care provider, of course. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from a variety of sources. And this is my favorite week of the month, because the last week of every month, I share a health mystery, a medical mystery. And most of these, as does this week's, come from the diagnosis column in the New York Times Magazine. It's written by Dr. Lisa Sanders. This one is entitled, "The Electric Toothache." The pain in her jaw baffled every dentist. X-ray after X-ray showed nothing unusual, but her doctors could see how agonizing her condition was. What was wrong? Quiet jazz played on the radio as the 69-year-old woman cruised down Interstate 57 from her home in Chicago Heights to an appointment at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Suddenly, a thunderbolt of pain hit the right side of her jaw. The intensity brought tears to her eyes and her hand to her face. She quickly pulled off the road. Once the car was fully stopped, she gingerly probed her lower jaw, seeking the exact tooth that was sending this impulse of jagged electricity through her mouth. Then the pain stopped as suddenly as it had started. It had lasted only minutes, but felt like an eternity. She'd had this pain a few times in the last couple of weeks. The first time was brushing her teeth, and whammo! Same pain, same place. That time she had to grip the sink until it passed. It was confusing. She'd always taken good care of her teeth and never even had a toothache. Weeks later, she sat in the reclined chair as her dentist swung his light into position, directing the beam onto the right side of her lower jaw. "It looked fine," he murmured. He tapped each tooth with a metal tool. No pain. He probed the gums gently. No pain. He took X-rays of her jaw. Normal. There was a filling in one tooth near the remembered site of pain, the dentist told her. Maybe the filling was cracked and was causing pain. He suggested that they drill it out and fit her with a crown. She agreed, somewhat reluctantly. She was on Medicare and had no dental insurance. But if it meant she would never have that pain again, it would be worth the $1,600 she had to pay out of pocket. Still, just days after the crown was in place, the same knife of pain stopped her in her tracks. This time she went to her father's longtime dentist. He examined her recent X-rays. Nothing abnormal. This dentist took more X-rays. Still nothing. He wondered if she was grinding her teeth and fitted her for an oral appliance that would keep her from putting pressure on her back teeth. Another $485. She wore it religiously, but it did nothing to change the pain, which now came with increasing frequency. A third dentist also saw nothing. Maybe she needed a root canal, he suggested, and sent her upstairs to see an endodontist. That specialist took his own X-rays and reported that no, she did not need a root canal. He didn't know what was causing her pain either. A theory at last. A friend's daughter worked as a hygienist in another dental office in Frankfort, Illinois. The woman was scheduled for her routine biannual cleaning, and in that chair, the pain struck again. The worst yet. The simple motion of opening her mouth for the hygienist brought on a pain so unexpected and so severe that she began to sob uncontrollably. The hygienist, alarmed, called in Dr. Dominic Dubrovic. Dubrovic was a periodontist, a specialist in the structures surrounding the teeth. Through her tears, the woman described the pain. It was sharp like a knife, but charged with an unbearable electricity. It came erratically, 5, sometimes 10 times a day, nearly every day. usually when she was eating or drinking, sometimes when she was just talking. He examined her mouth. Dubrovnik, too, saw nothing. Yet another set of x-rays was uninformative. Trauma from grinding teeth could injure the nerve, but he saw no evidence that she was a tooth grinder. He checked for misalignment, which could cause pain in the joint of the jaw that could be referred to the teeth. Normal. He felt her neck for masses or an enlarged lymph nodes and could suggest, you know, that could suggest a tumor was the cause of her pain. She was being treated for carcinoid, a type of slow-growing cancer. He found nothing. He was sorry, he told her, but he too was baffled by her pain. By then, over a year into her ordeal, the woman decided she'd have to find a way to live with this pain. And she tried to adjust her life to avoid the triggers she'd identified. She started living on homemade smoothies, which allowed her to get the nutrition she needed without chewing or opening her mouth wide. And she avoided the cold, a real challenge in wintertime Chicago, but she was determined to manage. The woman kept in touch with Dubrovnik by phone. She was reluctant to go to the office where she would be charged for a visit. He understood that. Few of his older patients had dental insurance because dental care is not considered part of health care, at least not by most Medicare plans. 9 months after that terrible cleaning, the patient's phone rang. It was her friend's daughter, the dental hygienist. Dubrovnik had been thinking about her persistent pain since that visit, she said, and thought he had come up with an answer. He suggested she see a neurologist. He thought she might have something called trigeminal neuralgia. The trigeminal nerve provides sensation and movement to the face. As the name suggests, there are three main branches, the lowest serving the lower jaw and teeth. Any injury or pressure to that nerve will be felt as pain in the region it serves. That, he suspected, was the culprit. She looked up neurologists who took her insurance and made an appointment. It was months away, but she figured she could bear the wait now that there might be an answer. When she finally saw the doctor, he agreed with the diagnosis. An MRI confirmed it. There was an artery just above her jaw that was pressing on the lowest branch of her trigeminal nerve. Many patients with this disorder will ultimately need surgery, he told her, but sometimes medication will do the trick. He started her on oxcarbazepine, an anti-seizure drug that is effective in treating nerve pain. Within days, the pain disappeared. It felt like a miracle. The patient was pain-free for 3.5 glorious years. Then one day it returned with a passion. For over an hour, she was crippled by the stabbing electrical shock she thought she'd never have again. When the pain receded, she called the neurologist. It is common for the nerve compression to worsen with time, so he increased her dose of oxcarbazepine. That got rid of the pain again, and she was grateful for it. But the medication now left her feeling like a zombie, so tired and spacey that she could barely do anything. She couldn't drive, could barely think. She searched the internet for a surgeon who could help. She asked for referrals in the facial pain support groups she frequented online, and she quickly found a neurosurgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix who was highly recommended. She could stay with her daughter-in-law, who lived there. She flew to Arizona and met the doctor. She liked him immediately. He had a warm manner and answered her questions. An MRI showed exactly where the problem was. Using those images, as well as anatomical drawings, he explained what the surgery would entail. The maxillary artery, which took blood to the muscles of the jaw, was pressing on the nerve. The surgeon would cut into her scalp, just behind her ear, and lift that artery, gluing it to the bone above the nerve. It all made sense to her, and she eagerly scheduled the surgery. After the operation, as the anesthesia was wearing off, a nurse asked her if she had any pain. She was still groggy, but immediately recognized that she was completely pain-free, and this time it wouldn't be back. I spoke with the patient recently. She is still part of a group for facial nerve pain and told me that trigeminal neuralgia is sometimes called the suicide disease. She understood that. At one point, it crossed my mind, she said. But her faith helped. So did Dubrovec. That man saved my life. She had the surgery 2 summers ago and remains pain-free, but she will never forget the torment that dominated her life for so long. I would not wish that pain on my worst enemy, she told me, her voice thick with emotion. It's just that bad. Sadly, doctors like Dubrovec are rare, and these mysteries always inspire me because there is a doctor typically who just won't let it go, who won't let the case go, who will do everything to try and find a cure for the patient. Those doctors are rare, but it so happens that doctors as an overall profession are getting rare. So here's an article from the Harvard Health newsletter about navigating a doctor shortage. Being without a regular primary care provider can be perilous to your health. Here are some creative workarounds. When Leo's primary care doctor, who had overseen his health for 30 years, retired, Leo figured he'd simply switch to a provider his friend recommended. But the 60-year-old was in for a rude awakening. After many phone calls, Leo learned the practice wasn't accepting new patients, and neither were several others in his area. Feeling adrift, Leo wondered who would now become the trusted care quarterback, managing his routine health needs and coordinating with specialists if his health went awry. It's a growing dilemma. Harvard-led research, described in the March 2026 issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, found a precipitous decline in the number of primary care providers in the United States who are accepting new patients. How bad is the decline? About 544,000 primary care doctors are currently on the job in the United States, according to KFF, a nonprofit foundation focused on national health issues. But the nation faces a projected shortage of up to 87,000 primary care providers by the 2030s, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. Meanwhile, the roster of nurse practitioners and physician assistants, who can oversee many routine health needs but not necessarily complex diagnoses, isn't increasing fast enough to fill the gap. What's driving the shortage? Saddled with crushing medical school debt, fewer budding physicians are choosing primary care, which tends to pay less than other specialties, says Dr. Daniel Sands, a primary care doctor at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It has become very hard to be a primary care physician because of the financial constraints, and our health care system emphasizes sick care instead of well care, Dr. Sands says. The doctors that did choose to go into primary care are retiring, some of them early, because of burnout. At its heart, primary care is a specialty centered around keeping you healthy, catching problems early, effectively managing chronic conditions, and maintaining an enduring relationship between you and your doctor. Done right, Dr. Sands says, it fosters a partnership that follows you through every stage of life. In the absence of a primary care doctor, your health is more vulnerable. Things fester, he says. Chronic conditions go unmanaged and cancers go undetected. Diabetes and high blood pressure can get out of control, and you could have a heart attack or stroke. All of these are downstream complications. You can certainly take certain steps to ward off health issues while you're between doctors, such as eating healthily, exercising, prioritizing sleep, limiting alcohol, and monitoring weight and blood pressure. Good habits like these help whether or not you have a doctor. Still, I don't think you can fully protect your health without a primary care provider, Dr. Sands says. If you have a chronic condition, you may need regular blood tests or prescriptions, and you may run out of medication because you can't find a new doctor. That's a terrible position to be in. So, here are some practical solutions. If you can't find a primary care doctor, it's time to think outside the box to get the care you need. Try these strategies. Look to group practices. They may have more availability, and if one doctor leaves the practice, it should be easier to transfer your care to a colleague. Tap insurance company resources. These might include an online provider directory with a new patient filter and other search tools to help you find a good match. Check hospital-affiliated practices. Academic medical centers often employ large teams of internists or primary care providers. They may also offer residency training clinics where new doctors are gaining valuable experience. Consider telehealth for routine care. Online practices do pose pitfalls. You'll need to upload self-gathered data such as blood pressure readings, and the clinician can't examine you. But many handle chronic disease monitoring, common health issues, and medication refills. It's not the same as having someone who knows you, however, Dr. Sands says. Try pharmacy clinics. Typically staffed by nurse practitioners or physician assistants, these often convenient locations can tackle everyday ailments as well as vaccinations, but they're largely not doing chronic condition management, Dr. Sands says. Use urgent care strategically. These centers can't substitute for ongoing care, but their staff can evaluate and treat minor illnesses or injuries. And lastly, explore concierge or direct primary care. Both are membership models for a fee ranging from hundreds to thousands of dollars. Offer greater access to a primary care provider, including quick scheduling and longer visits. But the fees are out of reach for many people, Sands says. Much less debilitating than the trigeminal neuralgia that our first article talked about. This article, also from the Harvard Health Letter, talks about a headache that starts in your neck. Cervicogenic headaches usually cause aching or pressure-like pain that radiates from the neck to one side of the head. Do you ever experience pain that starts at the base of your skull and spreads to one side of your forehead? It could be a cervicogenic headache. The name for these headaches comes from the Latin word cervix, meaning neck, and the Greek word gen, meaning to give origin to. These recurrent headaches stem from an underlying problem with the bones and nearby structures of the cervical spine, says Dr. Sait Ashina, associate professor of neurology and assistant professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and director of the Comprehensive Headache Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cervicogenic headaches are often triggered by head-neck movement, usually in people who have a tender, achy neck with a limited range of motion, he adds. Who gets cervicogenic headaches and why? Cervicogenic headaches account for up to 20% of chronic headaches, often in women. Cervicogenic headaches are sometimes mistaken for tension-type headaches or migraines, which can also be associated with neck pain. But those headaches are far more common. In any given year, up to 4% of people have a cervicogenic headache, while 12% of people have a migraine, and up to 38% have a tension-type headache. Known as primary headaches, these headaches are thought to be caused at least in part by factors within the brain or nervous system itself. In contrast, cervicogenic headaches are secondary headaches, which means they're caused by an underlying medical condition, Dr. Ashina explains. Cervicogenic headaches often originate from a problem in the upper cervical spine, which can initiate pain signals along the nerves known as C1, C2, and C3, says Dr. Ashina. Possible causes include a herniated or slipped disc, arthritis, or an injury such as whiplash. Keeping your head in an unnatural position for long periods of time may also contribute to cervicogenic headaches. For example, hunching over electronic devices such as a smartphone, tablet, or laptop can make your head tilt forward. The resulting combination of pain and stiffness is sometimes called tech neck or text neck. How are these headaches diagnosed? Primary care physicians often diagnose cervicogenic headaches, but referral to a specialist such as a general neurologist, pain specialist, physiatrist, who specializes in physical medicine and rehabilitation, or orthopedist can be helpful. Imaging tests such as X-rays, CT, or MRI are typically used to help pinpoint injuries or conditions that affect the cervical spine. In about 70% of cases, the disorder results from problems with the discs or facets in the C2 and C3 area, says Dr. Ashina. Facets are small joints between the vertebrae that provide stability and flexibility. The physician will also perform a thorough physical examination, including assessing the range of motion in the person's neck and checking whether certain movements provoke the headache or make it worse. Treating cervicogenic headaches. Unlike migraines, cervicogenic headaches may respond well to pain relievers, including acetaminophen, also known as Tylenol, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, like ibuprofen, Advil, Motrin, and others. But physical therapy, which includes manual therapy and therapeutic exercises, is also considered first-line treatment for cervicogenic headaches, although it can temporarily make the headaches worse. According to one study, 72% of people who completed 6 weeks of physical therapy reduced their headache frequency by 50% or more after a year. Other therapies include injections of steroids or anesthetics, targeted nerve block procedures, or surgery, but only as a last resort and when the cause is amenable to surgical intervention. Some people with spinal conditions seek treatment from chiropractors. Those who do should be sure that any manipulation around the neck area is very gentle with no high-velocity thrusts, Dr. Ashina cautions. These brief but rapid manipulations can lead to a tear in one of the neck's main arteries, a rare cause of stroke. So what exactly are the symptoms? The pain of a cervicogenic headache starts at the back of the neck at the base of the skull and radiates to the head and face, usually to the forehead and sometimes behind the eyes or even to the shoulder. While typically described as one-sided, these headaches may affect both sides of the head. Symptoms that are common with migraines, such as nausea and sensitivity to light and sound, usually don't occur with cervicogenic headaches, but some people have both types of headaches, which can make cervicogenic headaches challenging to diagnose. Staying with the Harvard Health Letter, let's move from the head to the lower extremities. This article is about treating Achilles tendon trouble. You can heal from Achilles tendonitis and even a tendon rupture, usually without surgery. Pain at the back of your lower leg, just above the heel, may signal a problem with your Achilles tendon. This thick, fibrous band connects the calf muscles to the heel bone, enabling you to raise your heel off the ground and move forward. Your Achilles tendons allow you to walk, run, and jump. They're also vulnerable to injury and wear and tear. An overworked Achilles tendon can become irritated and inflamed, leading to Achilles tendonitis, also known as Achilles tendinopathy. The tendon can even tear partially or completely. This is called an Achilles tendon rupture. Achilles tendon ruptures. People who engage in sports that involve running and jumping, such as tennis, pickleball, soccer, and basketball, can tear an Achilles tendon from a sudden movement that overstretches the tendon. This doesn't happen only to athletes. Even accidents like stepping on a rock at a beach and slipping in a certain way can rupture the Achilles tendon, says Dr. Gregory Warias, a foot and ankle surgeon with Harvard-affiliated Mass General Brigham Sports Medicine. When the Achilles tendon tears, you may hear a popping sound and have immediate pain. These injuries must be treated properly, whether with or without surgery. Treatment partially depends on the location of the rupture. Treatment for ruptures. A rupture in the middle of the Achilles tendon, called a mid-substance rupture, may heal without surgery if you get the proper care soon after the injury. If I see a patient in the first 48 to 72 hours and their lower leg was properly immobilized in the emergency department, urgent care, or doctor's office, we can consider non-surgical management, says Dr. Warias. Immobilization is done with a cast or boot that places the foot in a toe-down position called plantar flexion for a few weeks. Physical therapy starts once the tendon starts to heal. If treatment is too late or incorrect, the damaged tendon can lengthen and loose tension, causing weakness. Gaps may develop in the tendon. These may eventually require surgery. Dr. Warias will also surgically repair mid-substance ruptures in people who engage in regular high-intensity sports because surgery typically results in a shorter recovery time and lower chance of another rupture. The Achilles tendon can also tear in such a way that it pulls off the heel bone. This is called insertional rupture. Most of these cases require surgery. Achilles tendonitis is usually related to activity. People who are very active, who ramp up an activity too quickly, can irritate the Achilles tendon, says Dr. Warias. Some antibiotics in the class of fluoroquinolones, such as ciprofloxacin, known as Cipro, and levofloxacin, can increase the risk of Achilles tendonitis and tendon rupture regardless of activity level. With Achilles tendonitis, you'll feel pain and tenderness along the tendon, particularly after rest. The first couple of steps in the morning or after you've been sitting for a while tend to be very painful, says Dr. Warias. There are two types of Achilles tendonitis. Mid-portion tendonitis involves the center of the tendon, where a thick bump sometimes forms. Insertional tendonitis affects the area where the tendon attaches to the heel bone. Regardless of the location, treatment starts with non-surgical measures. That's all we have time for today. Tune in next week, and I'll give you a few tips about how to treat that tendonitis. And we're also going to start a series on chronic pain. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The health issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. As always, thanks for listening.